is Sean Delaney with Inside Education, your weekly supplement of professional development for educators and anyone interested in teaching and learning on 103.2 Dublin City FM and online. You can listen to or download over 300 podcasts of previous episodes of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. On this week's programme, I'm bringing you three new excerpts from guests who featured recently on the programme. Later, we'll hear from Arjen Walls on sustainability in education and David Powell, who is an expert on further education. But first, we'll hear from Frank McNally, who featured on last week's programme, number 341, to mark his keynote address to the annual conference of the Literacy Association of Ireland. On that programme, Frank discussed his own education and how he became the chief contributor to the Irishman's Diary column in the Irish Times. At the end of the previous interview, Frank discussed how his two Leaving Cert English teachers had praised his writing. I asked him to what he attributed his competence in writing from such a young age.
I can only say reading, you usually you have to read to be able to write.
You were only 16 at this time.
Yeah, I must have read. I mean, I read the usual crap. I must have read all of Enid Blyton's books, which, as we all know, are truly terrible. They're an abomination of literature. I think
she's able to tell a good story.
But she could tell a good story, and she certainly had me hooked. I remember I was an avid reader of Enid Blyton until I was about ten. I'd say maybe even 12. Until one of my older sisters, one day said, "Are you still reading Enid Blyton?" And overnight, I realised, oh God, I must be too old to be reading. And it was a terrible wrench at the time, but I stopped reading her. I thought it was time to, like St. Paul, I had to put away childish things. I'm a man now. I started reading slightly more advanced literature. But I think it's reading that makes you a writer. Although I do remember, funny enough, hearing J.P. Dunleavy, the novelist who died there, was last year, being interviewed quite late in life at the Electric Picnic of all things, and he was very, very quiet. And for a man who wrote a lot of very colourful books and had a very colourful life, he was quite an uncolourful speaker, at least at that stage of his career. But I remember him being asked about his literary influences, and he couldn't name any. He said, you know, he just seemed to be at a loss. And he said, well, you know, as a writer, I find you just have to write and not read. But look, you have to read. You have to read. It's the only way you learn to write. But then, obviously, you have to write to become a good writer. You have to write probably badly for a time to become a good writer. I can't. I wasn't like a youthful W.B. Yeats or Samuel Beckett. I wasn't sort of a brilliantly gifted student. It was, you know, by the standards of the time, both my English teachers thought I wrote it. I could write a nice essay, but it didn't translate itself in either of the exams. I think in the end, I think in the end, even at the second attempt, I got a C in English. I'm pretty sure didn't even get the B. So there's a message there.
Two more questions, Frank. First of all, from your perspective, what is school for, or what are schools for?
Gosh, that is a hard question. I could wax poetic and say schools are about opening your mind, and I think I know one of the things that I like. One of the things that I learned going through life is that the more you learn, the less you know, or at least the less you're sure of. Now, maybe that is the ultimate thing that you have to learn. But when you're younger, you can, in the bliss of ignorance, you can be sure about so many more things. I just realize now that everything is complicated. Everything, you know, and history is the most complicated thing of all. And maybe the people who don't realize how complicated it is are the people who are going to repeat the mistakes of history. This is interesting in view of where Ireland is at the moment. You know, Brexit and people not worrying about what might happen if the border comes back, because we've had a generation where it just wasn't an issue. And I think, you know, they talk about corporate memory, but, you know, national memory is being lost, because so many people who lived through the first one have died or got old and doddery. That's a long-winded question. I mean, for so many years, I know the system that I grew up in was to prepare you for jobs, and there was some of that. You know, that was definitely drilled into us at some stage. You know, I grew up on a farm, and the message from an early age is you get off the farm, you know, get yourself a job in Dublin. And of course they thought, for our parents' generation, if you weren't going to be a priest, if you're a Catholic, you know, that would be the first port of call. That was a fairly secure career in itself, apart from anything else. But if you weren't going to be one of those, they wanted you either to get, you know, civil service job or the bank. And in my case, I ended up in a civil service job. So some of that must have rubbed off as well, that you just, education was for becoming proficient in passing entrance exams. But, you know, in general, I think I suppose the fact that I'm still at it in various ways, that I would still do, you know, I would still do courses and things. And, you know, in the recent past, I've had yet another go. I spent a month in Paris, yet again, trying to learn French within the last couple, 2 or 3 years, at an age when I should have given up being a student, but I still can't resist. So I must be a level, there must be an extent to which I believe in education for its own sake and just broadening the mind and finding out new things. I do have, to get back to my talk title, it was about Irish English and just, but you know, about reading the landscapes. I have a perennial interest in you know, Irish place names and the stories that are buried in them, Irish personal names, nicknames, and the personal histories behind those. Probably because nowadays I have a vested interest anyway, because I'm always looking for something to write about tomorrow, and so you're always looking for quirky or interesting stories, and there are just so many and things like that. So, yeah, education for its own sake.
And finally, Frank, you've been doing the Irishman's Diary now for well over a decade. What have you learned from the writing yourself?
Again, I've learned, if I didn't know it beforehand, one of the things I've learned is that shorter is better. I know when I started doing it, it's quite strict now, because I've lived through several page designs, and every time we have a, you know, page redesigns, every time the paper is redesigned, they introduce more white space. If you look at the Irish Times from 20 or 30 years ago, when I would have been a slab often of grey print, you know, and historically, like, the further you go back, the grayer and denser it got, and the print was smaller, and of course paper was scarce and expensive going back. It's not so much now, but every time they redesign it, they introduce more white space and design values, and so the word count of columns like mine has become shorter and shorter, and it is definitely better. When I started off, it used to be about, it was never more than, certainly it was more flexible anyway. I used to aim for about, you know, 900 maximum, but you could be, sometimes it could be 950, could be 1,000. On very rare occasions, I might have written a column of 1,050 words. Very rarely would have got up to for 1,100. But you could, because it was flexible and it's on the letters page and the letters were fitted around it, the sub-editor, if you give him any kind of advance notice, he could fit that length of... But when you had to do it for that length, unless it was a really good subject, unless you had, and occasionally it would be there would be a good subject that was worth that many, it was worth the longer word count, and it would be very hard to compress it into the shorter one. But I know that there were days when, because you didn't have a good idea, you would end up, instead of using one bad idea and keeping it short, you would use two or three bad ideas and try and link them together. And it would end up becoming kind of a rambly, discursive thing. And it would be, inevitably, to get back to what George Bernard Shaw said, it would be longer than it should be. You'd end up writing 1,000 words. And I can spot those when I see them in the, I come across them in the archive sometimes, I'm looking for something, I can spot those columns from the first paragraph. I can see that's kind of flabby and drawn out.
Is that your own or other people's?
Mine, you know, and never mind other people's, but I can see I was filling the space. When you have a good idea and you're writing it with kind of energy, doing it in 800 words, you know, and a good idea written with sort of energy and, you know, in the heat of the moment, albeit, like, I will always rewrite them, polish them afterwards, is better than one that you spend all day on and that you drag out by 200 or 300 words over the to try and massage, you know, to try and make up for the lack of whatever you know, the thing you didn't have in the first place. I can see how that applies to whole books as well. People end up, they lose their way in books. The material runs away on them and the book becomes flabby and directionless. In general, if I didn't know at the start, I definitely know now that shorter is better. What else have I learned? I don't know, I go off and this is probably a problem in this interview because of what I do, it's an occupational hazard. I go off on so many tangents, there are tangents off the tangents. Yeah, no, if I boiled it down to one thing, keep it short.
A suitable, concise and short ending to my interview with Frank McNally, and what interesting tangents he shared with us over the full interview. Next we'll hear from David Powell from the University of Huddersfield, who spoke to me in programme 338 about the soul of teacher education and about the viewing frame he developed to study teacher educators' practices. We spoke on the edges of the annual conference of the Association for Teacher Education of Europe. A question I posed to David Powell is one I posed to many guests on the programme. Was there a teacher who had a significant impact on you? This was his reply.
Many. There have been different people at different phases in my life, really. People who might have been role models when I became a teacher, and then people who become role models whilst I've been a teacher educator. So if I think of people who I remember as teachers and who were very kind and supportive and nurturing, then I can think of a lady called Anne McCartney who taught me at primary school, and I was a bit of a rogue, really, and she just took me under her arm and turned me around. I remember Dr. Barker, who taught me politics A-level. I mean, he was just fantastic. He would cite Gladstonian speeches. And I mean, for a young lad, I was looking for something and I would get lost in that. You know, his command of the subject inspired me. You know, I've always wanted to, you know, inspire people by not overwhelming with knowledge, but just giving them some knowledge that inspires them. And he inspired me. And then I think of colleagues when I first became a teacher, somebody called Alan Blackwell. He became like an older brother to me. We weren't family, but he looked after me, you know, in the schoolyard, when I first became a teacher, really, and really nurtured me. And my father's been a great model. He was a further education teacher, not a teacher educator. You know, he taught me the discipline of things. And more recently, I mentioned Anya Svennen. She's been a great role model for me as a teacher educator. And it was her who brought me to ATE in the first place. But also she taught me how to research and, you know, how to approach things with research. And that, you know, has been very powerful too.
What is school for, or what are schools for?
I suppose there are many things, aren't they? Giving people opportunity, hope, changing lives, making the world a better place to live and practice in. And I think they are places for people to grow and feel safe, and to have people who are like-minded and help them. So, yeah, I think there are many things. I mean, that's an incomplete answer, but it's a starter anyway.
Who or what inspires you?
Well, there are people around me that inspire me. You know, people you hear, you know, that. I mean, there are some of the people at conference who've come. I mean, I've come from, what, I've gone on a plane 2 hours. What about the people from Japan? For whom English is their first language are coming here. They inspire me. Some of my colleagues, some of my student teachers, and then, you know, you see things, people in the papers, people who are just making small changes in the world. There are many people who inspire me, and I try to look out for them to catch a bit of their energy, you know, and hopefully draw on that, you know, to get me through the next day, week, whatever.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
Well, actually, I'm going to turn this round because I use Stephen Kemys's work a lot, but he's part of a team. So actually, and when I talk with that team, they know, you know, he comes first. But actually, Jane Wilkinson is somebody who works with the Kemys team, and their work on practice architectures and ecologies of practice is really shaping my thinking at the moment. That's really shaped a lot of how I used it as a conceptual framework for my thesis, but it's shaping some of the bigger questions that I'm asking. I have to say, and you can see on the table, I have books. I'm a book boy. I don't spend a lot of time reading blogs, to be honest. I have a presence on Twitter and I read some things. But fundamentally, you know, I have my students I serve, okay, and sometimes I take myself away and read books. I mean, these have been carried around for 3 days. And you know, you can see, I mean, look at that. It's just like vandalized.
You know. But that's quite a thin one. And it's called Teacher Educators in the 21st Century, yeah, by Jerry
Chernovinsky. Okay, and I sort of drew on that. It's been shaping my thinking. And they're great. They're a great publishing house, Critical Publishing. And there's actually that's another one of their books I was reading. Let me just try and dig this out. Beginning Teachers Learning, Making Experience Count by Catherine Byrne, Hazel Hagger and Trevor Mutton. I read that recently. And it's had the same treatment, which for the effect for the listener is normally a little note at the top of the page, you know, little stickers, and then highlighted normally in yellow, words, things like that, you know. And I love books, and in fact, I've just got a book, it's not very recent, it's from 1972, but I'm going back to just doing some work to try and pick up some history lessons about further education, researching further education in England, and what we can learn from that and the issues, and whether we've actually solved the problem or we're still just, you know, just going round and talking about it.
Tinkering around the edges.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What from your own experience of primary or secondary education informs your practice as an educator today?
I'm well into my later age of life. I'm not quite near retirement, but I'm heading towards it. So actually, primary and secondary are less memorable in some ways than some of my more recent experiences, sort of university-based education. And if I can be a little transgressive and talk about that, I mean, I did an EdD, and sitting in classes, listening to ideas, and just being fired up by an idea or a piece of some words, you know, and people who were teaching really complex ideas with very effective, quite what might be described as simple, and I don't mean simple in its plainest form, but actually very straightforward activities like manipulatives, manipulating cards into order and things like that. I remember that Robin Simmons teaching a class, you know, on interpretive methodology and using that, and I find that very, very powerful. So that's at the forefront of my mind.
That was David Powell from the University of Huddersfield. Finally, I'm bringing you another part of my interview with Arjen Walls, who spoke to me on programme 339 about sustainability and education. I asked Arjen Walls what the lightbulb moment was for him. How did he become interested in the area of sustainability and education?
I go back to my own youth, and I think this is true for a lot of people who are active in sustainability and environment and ecology. My parents both were environmental educators, you could say. My father worked for the City of The Hague as a director of environmental education. It was a big part of his work. He was co-founder of the Foundation for Environmental Education, which does the eco schools and the blue flags. He died sadly 12 years ago, but he took us, and my mother too. She worked with primary schools monitoring water quality already in the 80s between the Rhine, you know, on the Rhine River. Holland and Dutch and German schools participated, and they would meet at the border to exchange their findings and to have an inter sponsored by the European Union. This was a very powerful education experience where the river connected these schools and their lives were connected through the river. So early citizen science, you could say. And they took us camping, they took us outdoors a lot, my parents. And I think that is where the initial, that's where the seed was planted, you could say. Then I decided to study environmental engineering, but after a year already I felt that the kinds of problems that we are facing cannot be solved with technology alone. And I felt more and more drawn to the social sciences. And I was really thinking the problems that we have are not between the ecological problems between the North and South Poles. They're really problems that are between our ears. They need a different mindset, different values, different principles. We need to develop alternative lifestyles. And so through my early years and my exposure to my parents and their thinking, but also being outside a lot, I developed, I think, a foundation for this type of work that I'm doing today. To the delight of my parents, I suspect I shifted also from engineering to education, which is where they were coming from in the first place. But I always said as a child, it's no use, you know, waiting for people to start loving nature That will never happen. And we have so many people on the planet. We need to have technological fixes. Otherwise, it's going to be too late. And there's some truth in that still, I think. It's not about that everybody comes to love nature, but it is about that everybody gets to experience green spaces, healthy air, good sense of community. I think we need in cities what we are seeing today, the rise of urban agriculture, localized food systems, the rise of permaculture. The ruralization of the urban is becoming as important as, and maybe more important than, the urbanization of the rural. And that's an interesting counter trend where people see that green is healthy. Green is actually, from an economical point of view, green spaces in cities are more popular and more desired than non-green spaces. Environments that have lots of green make people also perform better in what they do. And young people learn better. If they have green school grounds and they spend a lot of time outdoors, they can concentrate better inside. So there's lots of incentives to become part of this transition.
Was there a teacher who had a significant impact on you growing up?
Well, yes. I would say that Bill Stapp, founding father of environmental education in North America, University of Michigan, he was my supervisor or mentor, better word, when I did my PhD. He was very inspiring, in part because he was selfless. He really listened and cared for his students. He was very good at boundary crossing. We did the work that I did around my dissertation was based in inner city Detroit in the African-American middle schools, where we developed a program, Action Research and Community Problem Solving, in the late 80s, that still has been very foundational for what I do today. And when I hear myself speak, I recognize a lot of these ideas were already in place, in a way, over 30 years ago. The big difference now is that I'm talking at education, general education conferences like the ATEE, like ARA, like ESER, where mainstream education is engaging with this question now, and it wasn't 30 years ago. That was a small niche, but these niches are becoming regimes, and these regimes are becoming landscapes, to use transition and ecological metaphors.
Do you have a favorite book or blog or writer about education?
Well, at the moment, I'm intrigued from an economy point of view, and intrigued by Kate Raworth's Donut Economy is a very interesting one. Martha Nussbaum in education is a very interesting, because I find that big education names, scholars like Gert Biesta from Holland, Michael Apple from the US, and Peter McLaren, but also Martha Nussbaum, that in their early years never talked about ecological and social, maybe more the social injustice and inequity, but they are also very much concerned about the state of the planet. And they are engaging with these questions more and more in their latest work, maybe because they're getting older, maybe because they have grandchildren of their own. So they are also beginning to see that the relational and the equitable doesn't limit itself to people. It also extends to include the non-human and the more than human. And that sense of place and identity is critical, and that education should help develop such sensitivity for place, identity, other species. So their work is inspirational, and somebody like Naomi Klein, I think, comes not necessarily from an education point of view, but offers also a lot of critical perspectives on education. So her work, This Changes Everything, for instance, is also very inspiring.
And finally, Arjen, if people want to find out more about your work or about the matters you've talked about today in general, where would you direct them?
Probably not to promote myself, but I have a blog. It's called transformativelearning.nl. It's based in the Netherlands, where I post a lot about the work we do at Wageningen, but also at Gothenburg, where I work. There's another site called transgressivelearning.org, which is a site that's about our T-Learning project, sponsored by the ISSC. And that is about transgressive learning, disruptive capacity building, transformative learning, learning to make change, transdisciplinary learning, connecting disciplines, transcending them, and transboundary learning, linking science, society, in the world of work, governance, and so on. And that has cases from also from the Global South, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Ethiopia, South Africa, Vietnam and India, and then and Colombia, and then also from the North, Netherlands and Sweden. Interesting cases of education, informal mostly, some formal but mostly informal, community-based learning, responding to global systemic dysfunction. And that is a good site to visit as well. And then there's the Global Education Monitor Report 2016, Education for People and Planet, Creating Sustainable Futures for All, which I think is a very good background document in multiple languages, open access, freely downloadable through UNESCO. So it's a UNESCO report. I also recommend that people have a look at that.
So plenty of opportunities for us to learn more about education for sustainability, recommended by Arjen Walls, who is one of the guests on today's programme. My main interview with Professor Walls can be listened to in programme 339. That brings this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to Frank McNally, David Powell and Arjen Walls for their time. You can listen back to this programme and over 340 others covering all aspects of education by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. My book about education, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available for purchase from online bookstores or directly from the publisher Routledge. You can also ask your local library to order a copy. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.